Welcome to The Rest is History. It is the 3rd of January. It is the latest in our series on the 12 days of Christmas, or 13 days, which is what we're doing. And we are doing anniversaries every day. Tom chooses one, I choose one. And Tom, you're going to go first today, aren't you, with a man who I think is very close to your heart.
Yes, well, featured in one of the very earliest episodes that we did on the idea of social media echoing the way that printing and the new media had been used in the Reformation. And of course, the absolute master of that was Martin Luther, the man who is often seen as the father of the Reformation. And yesterday, Dominic, we had the fateful year that saw the conquest of Granada, Columbus, the expulsion of the Jews from Spain, one of the kind of key dates, as you said, for, you know, this is the end point of the Middle Ages. Yeah. And another obvious date would be the early 1520s, when Martin Luther really gets the Reformation going. And possibly the key moment in that, the moment that marks the kind of the point where the schism is formalized, is when Luther gets excommunicated, officially excommunicated, cast out from the Catholic Church by the Pope. And that happened on the 3rd of January, 1521.
So Tom, set the scene for us. So I think it's 1517, isn't it, that Martin Luther famously nails, or in fact, probably doesn't nail, his 95 theses to the door of that church in Wittenberg. And that's the moment that's commonly seen as sort of kickstarting the Protestant Reformation. So this is 4 years after that. And what's been happening in that kind of, I mean, what's the backstory to all this?
Well, so essentially Luther has all kinds of issues that are theological and doctrinal, and they increasingly strike at the very heart of the great kind of edifice of doctrine that the Catholic Church and specifically the papacy kind of exists to uphold. And the question is, that has always confronted the Catholic Church throughout the Middle Ages, whenever confronted by, you know, heretical movements, is what do you do with them? Do you try and kind of integrate them into the fabric of the church, or do you kind of expel them and try and extirpate them? And there are kind of various strategies that are adopted in the years that immediately follow Luther's kind of, you know, pronouncement, his nailing of the theses. So there's a cardinal Catahan, who comes and attempts to negotiate with Luther directly, but Luther isn't really having any of it. And when Luther turns his back on Catahan, goes back to Wittenberg, which is under the rule of the Elector Friedrich of Saxony, who is very, very proud of Luther. You know, Luther's made himself the most famous person in Europe. Wittenberg has become this kind of great center you know, it's the focus of attention across Christendom. So in a sense, Luther is kind of safe there, out beyond the reach of the papacy. Basically, Luther has decided that, you know, it's beyond the point of no return. It's on the 15th of June in 1520 that the Pope, who's Leo X, he issues a papal bull, which Protestants always find a very amusing phrase, but it's an official papal announcement, in which he warns Luther that, you know, he is going to be excommunicated unless he retracts all kinds of heretical statements. You know, excommunication is absolutely happening. And this bull is called Exsurge Domine, Arise, O Lord. It gets issued in the summer of 1520. On the 10th of December, Luther has a copy of it, and he very, very publicly, very symbolically burns it.
Yeah, doesn't he? It's this great public spectacle, isn't it? Yes. That he puts it in the fire, and a lot of shouting about Antichrist or something.
There's always a lot of shouting about Antichrist. He goes to one of the three city gates of Wittenberg, and it's a kind of carrion pit. It's where people burn kind of old clothing. It's a place where you get rid of rubbish.
Right. It's like basically a municipal tip, basically.
It's a municipal tip, yes, exactly. And he's gone rushing around all the libraries of Wittenberg, trying to get out books of canon law, which is the you know, the law that specifically applies to the church. And he piles them up and he chucks them on the fire, and he chucks ex Serge Domine, this papal bull that's threatening him with excommunication, on the fire as well.
Wow.
And yeah, there's a lot of, you know, he calls the Pope Antichrist, all that kind of stuff. You know, it's he's courting excommunication. He wants it. And, you know, sure enough, that's what he gets. And that's what he gets on this day.
But Tom, I know this is a colossal topic. What's his motive?
He thinks he's doing God's will.
Right. And what has converted him prior to 1517?
Oh, Dominic. To this? I mean, that's...
Are you able to answer that in one sentence?
I suppose the kind of the bedrock of the Reformation, the central challenge to the authority of the Catholic Church is Luther's idea: you don't need the superstructure of the church to provide you with salvation, that is God's gift.
Yeah.
And that therefore it's your personal relationship with God, it's your personal relationship with the Spirit, it's your personal relationship with Scripture that should determine your behavior as a Christian. And yeah, that all the, so this is why he burns the books of canon law, is that he comes to see the claims of the Catholic Church to embody, you know, that there is no salvation except through the Catholic Church, underpinned by the papacy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why he comes to see the Catholic Church as a kind of monstrous distortion of Christian teaching. And it's why he sees the figure of the Pope, so yeah, not the individual popes, but the, you know, the papacy, as essentially Antichrist. And, you know, there is no question that by the standards of the Catholic Church, Luther entirely merits excommunication. So there's kind of, you know, there's absolute, you know, tens, 20, 30, 40, 50, you could just kind of, so you, separation of justification from sanctification, extrinsic, forensic, imputed justification, fiduciary faith, private judgment over and against ecclesiastical infallibility, the rejection of the seven deuterocanonical books, the denial of venial sin, the denial of merit, sola scriptura, so only, you know, only scripture, not the kind of the canons of the Catholic Church, radically private judgment. If we're all priests, why should we not also have the power to test and judge what is right or wrong in matters of faith? Denial that the Pope has the right to call a council. Only justified men can do good works. I mean, these are, so I won't go through them all. I'm sure listeners will be relieved to hear. But essentially, what these are systematic attacks on everything that the Catholic Church has constructed, not just over the course of the Middle Ages, but in many cases over the period of late antiquity as well. And this is why it is so seismic. But and it's generated this profound schism that endures to this day. And you know, it's one that Christians continue to dream of healing.
That's not gonna happen though, is it?
Well, so 2 years ago in 2020, there was a group of theologians who belonged to something called the Altenburg Ecumenical Round Table, which had been founded back, I think, 1999, something like that. And they knew that the anniversary was coming up.
Yeah.
So they said, what about a kind of quid pro quo? So that the Pope would essentially withdraw the excommunication, and the Lutheran World Federation would kind of agree that the Pope wasn't the Antichrist. And
wow,
you know, wouldn't this be a kind of, you know, a good quid pro quo?
That's a big concession from the Lutherans, right? I mean,
well, I gather that the Lutheran World Federation doesn't have the right to speak for Lutherans in this way.
Oh, really?
Of course, they're all Protestants, so that's all, you know.
Yeah, so you're all using your own individual judgment.
Yeah,
right?
Use your own individual judgment, exactly. So that's kind of the problem. But that obviously hasn't happened.
No,
but, I mean, I think there is kind of talk about it.
We went to Germany on holiday in 2016, so the year before the anniversary of the nailing or the non-nailing of the theses in Wittenberg, and they were selling, and we bought, a Playmobil figure of Martin Luther.
Yes, I think the best-selling Playmobil figure in Germany. I think so. Something extraordinary like that.
So Playmobil is quite a big deal in Germany because it is German. So there was a Playmobil park outside Nuremberg, which we've been to.
Yeah.
And we bought Martin Luther and Albrecht Dürer, who is a Playmobil figure.
Well, I know that the Martin Luther Playmobil character sold incredibly well
He's a great figure. We used to use him in battle. I used to arrange battles with my son's Playmobil and Lego figures, in which kind of Martin Luther would be leading a huge army of Protestants with sort of Daleks in it and Star Wars stormtroopers.
Did he have a Pope?
Against the armies of the Pope, yeah.
Well, did he have
like
a Playmobil Pope?
I'd get like the Emperor from Star Wars to be the Pope.
Well, Dominic.
It was quite loaded. It was quite.
That's quite
game.
Loaded.
Yeah. Yeah, but I mean, yeah.
Okay, well,
it's a very patriotic game.
I suppose that's a very middle English thing to be doing.
Yeah, exactly. I think most of the listeners will think that completely reasonable, and probably they've got similar stories to tell themselves, I imagine.
And promptly we lose all our Catholic listeners. I apologise for
Well, we've got a great bit of Catholicism coming up.
We do have a great, we've got a great Catholic, haven't we?
We have.
A great Catholic
writer. A top Catholic.
So, who you wrote about in Unheard.
And I deliberately did not mention his Catholicism at all.
And was
just
I cross?
Just out of propagandism. You were cross. Yeah, you
I
were.
Was cross.
Well, you were cross, but I think you were a little bit amused at the same time.
Well, I think, yes. So I think that Tolkien, Born on This Day, is Dominic's choice and counterbalances the Lutheran tone of the first half of this.
So we should come to Tolkien. Let's come to Tolkien after the break.
Hello, welcome back to our Protestant-Catholic-themed special today. We've had Luther being excommunicated in the first half, and in the second half, Dominic, it's J.R.R. Tolkien's birthday.
J.R.R. Tolkien being born. So it's his birthday. It's the 3rd of January, 1892. You know where Tolkien is born, Tom?
I do. Bloemfontein.
Yeah. Bloemfontein in the Orange Free State, as it then was. So he's the Tolkien family for a very English writer. He's got quite a sort of
he's
exotic,
German, weren't they?
Yeah, they're Germans. They're from apparently they originally
full of a toque. So the kind of the Tolk toque.
Yeah, yeah. So okay. Do you know where they're from? They're from East Prussia.
I did know that. Yeah.
So they wouldn't be German now. They would be kind of living in a Russian enclave.
Astonishing, isn't it?
So they come from near what's now Kaliningrad, but what was then Königsberg.
Oh, yeah, home of Kant.
And it's sort of, so his earliest known ancestor is somebody called Michel Tolkien, born around 1620. And they were, well, they moved to England in the early modern period at some point, and they made clocks and watches and pianos in London and Birmingham. Anyway, Arthur Tolkien, who is Tolkien's father, he was born in 1857. He was a bank manager, rather. unexcitingly.
Yes, the sword of fate. The ring of doom.
Yeah.
So, the bank statement of destiny.
Exactly. Well, you would, I mean, that's what would fill your mind with all this stuff. If
you know, it's kind of sending a bank state, you know, a checkbook to Galadriel or something.
So he's a bank manager and he is posted with his wife Mabel to.
Which is, not a.
So they are posted to Bloemfontein by the bank. And he goes off to work in the bank. And Tolkien is born in on the 3rd of January, 1892. And his brother, do you know what his brother's name was?
No.
Hillary.
What did he become?
I don't know. Maybe he became a bank manager as well. He didn't write a sort of series of fantasy novels. So
right.
I think we can forget about poor old Hillary. He was born in 1894. And basically when Tolkien J.R.R. was... they'd basically decided to go back to England for a big visit. So his mum gets on the boat with him and his brother and off they go. And his father has got some work to do, so he's going to follow them later. And he gets rheumatic fever. I don't actually know what that is, but it
sounds bad.
It's bad. And he dies before he even gets on the boat to join them.
So never remembered his father.
So they're in England visiting his mother's family, and they basically have to stay forever. So they end up staying in Birmingham, and they stay in a place, well, initially they live with her parents. Then in 1896, so when Tolkien is four, they move to this village of Sarehole. And then it was a village in North Worcestershire. Now it's basically in suburban Birmingham. And you can visit the mill, which is the inspiration for the mill. There's a mill and there's a bog. And they're the inspiration for some of the sort of the landscapes of the Lord of the Rings. So Tolkien
is it the Shire?
Exactly, it is the Shire. And then I think Tolkien
and then
about,
and then when Birmingham kind of moves in, it's the harrowing of the Shire.
Exactly, Birmingham swallows it up at exactly the moment when Tolkien is kind of a boy and then a teenager, the sort of tentacles of suburbia.
Mordor.
And the sort of Edwardian, Edwardian developers are swallowing it all up. But when Tolkien is 12, so he's lost his father in South Africa. And then when he is 12, his mother dies. She's a diabetic. And in those days, diabetics, with her particular kind of diabetes, didn't generally live beyond their mid-30s. And she doesn't. So she dies. A priest, there's a Catholic priest who's very close to the family, because of course they're Catholics. Mm-hmm. He's very close to the family. He arranges for the two Tolkien boys to go and live with an aunt in the centre of Birmingham, basically. So if anyone's been in
from the centre of Birmingham, to the middle of Mordor.
They live very close, in Edgbaston, very close to what is now, if you've ever driven through Birmingham, this big roundabout called the Five Ways Roundabout.
But also a cricket ground, of course.
Yeah. Well, I don't think Tolkien was a great cricketer. He was a rugby man, actually. He's a rugby player. So they go and live there, and they look out, and he looks out of his window, and there's factories, and there's warehouses, and shops, and stuff. And you can absolutely see where the nostalgia comes from, where the sense of a sort of lost paradise, where the sort of horror at industry and urbanism and modernity, all of that is woven into the story of this kind of boy.
Well, because when I read Lord of the Rings as a, you know, when I was young, I missed it all. But now
you would, and
you completely see that it's one of the great novels. You know, it's one of the great anti-urban novels.
Yeah.
It's one of the it's a very green novel.
It is. And that's a theme that I think people never noticed until probably the 70s.
It's one of the great portrayals of the impacts of industrialization.
It is. Absolutely it is. And it's not like Mordor is industrial, isn't it? And then of course the scouring of the Shire scene at the end of the
Lord of the Rings. But Saruman is the key figure.
He is, because he's fascinated by it. He's ingenious, isn't he? He's always creating machines.
Fire and machines.
Absolutely. And I know there are some people...
eugenics and all
kinds. There were some people listening to this who hate Tolkien and hate the Lord of the Rings and hate the fantasy genre. And that, I think, is completely fair enough. I think there's no reason why you should like it. But even if you don't like it, it does still matter. Because it is a brilliant mirror to the concerns of the 20th century. And the fact that so many millions of people did like it tells you something about its power.
But also, I would say,
a
mirror held up to the concerns of Catholics and Christians more generally in the 20th century. And
tell us a time. Go on, I'll give you a little bit of leeway.
I wrote about Tolkien in... Yeah.
By the way, just so the listeners know, as he's saying all, I would say he's kind of gearing up. And I get the sense of this colossal wedge of paper behind him that he's going to start reading.
No, I'm not. But the justification that I had, so I included him in a chapter that was basically about the First World War, the rise of fascism, and the Second World War.
Yes, I remember
the Holocaust.
It. Very good.
And I thought, is Lord of the Rings sufficient to bear the weight that I'm going to impose on its shoulders? I think it is, for kind of complex reasons to do with, Tolkien's attitude to the Jews, to the Nazis, to the firebombings that the RAF carried out in Germany. Tolkien said, Lord of the Rings is not an allegory, and so people have always been slightly nervous about weaving it into the events of the 20th century. But he'd fought in the trenches at the Somme.
Of course.
His son flew planes over occupied Germany. So he was very, very intimately involved in that. And I would argue that actually Lord of the Rings, far more than 1984, actually, is the great novel written about the horrors of the 20th century. And the reason that I say that is that even more than 1984, it's a colossal popular success. It's the best-selling novel of the 20th century.
Yeah.
And I would argue that a key reason for its popularity is that it gives a people, people who are suspicion of Christian orthodoxy, suspicious of Christian scripture, suspicious of Christian belief, a chance to experience what it is about Christianity that has made it so successful and so appealing and so powerful. Because in a sense, Lord of the Rings is the last great popular Christian work.
Because of the distrust of power, of strength, because of the celebration of smallness and all of those kinds of things.
And also,
Tom, there was this key moment. So for people who do know Lord of the Rings, if you hate the Lord of the Rings, you probably switched off already, let's be honest. But if you know the Lord of the Rings, you will know that at the end of the book, Frodo does not destroy the ring. He claims it for his own. He's weak. He is human and fallible. And then there's this kind of moment that Tolkien himself basically says in his letters is the kind of intervention of divine grace, because he is forgiven, should be merciful to Gollum. And they could have killed Gollum, but they didn't. They were merciful to Gollum. And of course, that's the moment that Gollum, he sort of leaps up and he bites Frodo's ring off, and then he falls
spoiler
in.
Alert. Spoiler alert.
Well, I mean, no one's going to be listening to it. I mean,
yeah.
Then he falls in, and it's through, what is it, fate? I mean, I think there's some line that Gandalf says, maybe it was meant to happen, this.
So you know the date on which that happens?
Oh, I do know. I've forgotten what it is. It's got some significance.
It does. It's the 25th of March.
Yeah.
Which is traditionally the date of both the crucifixion and the incarnation.
Oh, right. Very good.
And so for Tolkien, a profoundly significant date. And in general, the overt Christian allusions are minimal. You know, there are no gods at all in Lord of the Rings. But at this point, he does bring it in. And I think it's incredibly significant. Anyway, we mustn't. I don't think that we should talk much more about this because we're saving up an episode on Tolkien. We've got lots to talk about with
episodes plural lined up on Tolkien. later on.
So that'll woo the Catholics back.
Yeah, we've got the Catholics back. We've still got the Protestants on side. Tomorrow we're going to make a bid for the existentialists and the abolitionists, I think, aren't we?
Yes.
So we're basically appealing to every part of the community.
So an existentialist, abolitionist-themed special tomorrow. We will see you then. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.